Hello, everyone. Thank you for tuning in to The Naturalist Capitalist. I'm your host, Reed Coverdale. Real quick, if you're just visiting, if this is your first time here, please subscribe to the channel. I'm very excited. I got a very special guest today. He was one of the few people who correctly predicted the financial crisis of 2008. He's the CEO of Euro Pacific Capital. The man needs no introduction, but I'm going to give it to him anyways. He's been a huge influence on my life and lots of people who are into economics. Peter Schiff, how are you doing? Thanks for joining the program today.
I'm doing good. Thanks for inviting me on, Reed. I'm looking forward to spending a little time with you.
Absolutely, man. So I know we're on a time crunch, so I'm going to jump right in with the questions. So I'm a younger guy. I'm 27. But as long as I can remember, I was always told the lie that a healthy economy is one where we're just spending money. As long as we're spending money, the economy is healthy. And recently under President Trump, we were told that we had the greatest economy in the history of the world, but nobody had any savings. No one was invested in anything. And then as soon as COVID hit, it pricked the bubble and our economy got exposed for the sham that it was. But could you kind of quickly explain why investing and saving actually gives us a healthy economy versus just spending money?
Sure. Well, first of all, spending money can reflect a healthy economy, right? If you have a strong economy, it's vibrant, it's free, and people are very productive, and they're producing a lot of products and providing a lot of services, well, that's great. And people can spend the money that they earn because you earn money helping to produce those products or provide those services. So, yes, a very strong economy, you're going to have people spending money. But what people are doing is putting the cart before the horse. They're thinking just because strong economies have a lot of spending, that if we just spend a lot of money, we can somehow magically create a strong economy. You have to have the strong economy first. Then you get the spending. But what happens in the United States is we're able to spend a lot of money, but instead of earning it because we've produced stuff, we just borrow it. And then we end up spending money on the stuff that was produced abroad, and in the process, we accumulate all kinds of liabilities to the rest of the world because we're really borrowing to consume. But what we didn't do was save to produce, and that's really what we should have done. It's savings and underconsumption that really are responsible for economic growth. It's the income that we don't spend that we save. That money then becomes available to finance the capital investment that increases our industrial capacity, makes labor more productive by creating better tools and things like that for workers to use. And then when the economy becomes more productive, the reward for that increased productivity is increased consumption. But we're trying to cut corners. We don't want to do the hard work. We just want to skip right to the consumption. And we can do that for a while until the whole thing collapses because it's all built on a mountain of debt.
Yeah. So what a lot of people don't realize is a lot of these wars and a lot of the economic policies that our government uses are only enabled through ridiculously low interest rates that are not reflective of what they actually should be. But everybody in this country has gotten themselves saddled in so much debt that they really have no other option than to beg for low interest rates to maintain the lifestyle that they're already trapped in. So do you think that there's any hope of actually turning the economy around now that everybody is captured by this economic process we have of artificially low interest rates? Is there any way that people will ever choose to do the right thing, or are they just kind of trapped forever because of where they've ended up?
Well, you know, I think we're kind of in a trap that we're not going to be able to get out of because of the politics that's involved. But there is a viable way out. I mean, maybe it's not viable politically, but it's viable economically. And what you said is true. Because the Fed has held interest rates artificially so low for so long, and because the government has also guaranteed a lot of the debt, so a lot of Americans can borrow money at these low interest rates, but the lenders don't even care if they could repay the money. because you have government guaranteed student loans, mortgages, all sorts of borrowing that wouldn't take place absent a government guarantee. But we've got so much debt. And because interest rates have been held so low, everybody is looking for yield anywhere they can get it. And so that's enabled the securitization of high-risk consumer loans. We did that with subprime mortgages, and that, you know, resulted in the financial crisis. But that's being done now with all sorts of consumer debt, credit card debt. You know, there's all the popular, you know, buy now, pay later kind of stuff. Or when you go into a store and you can buy, you know, a mattress or, you know, a refrigerator, and you don't even have to put up any money. Well, behind the scenes, all that stuff is being securitized because everybody is looking for yield because you can't get any in the traditional places because the Fed is intervening. And so because credit has been so cheap and so plentiful, everybody is loaded up on it. So Americans have so much debt, it's impossible to pay it back. American citizens, the American government, corporations. So the only way that the debt can be serviced is if interest rates are held artificially low. And at this point, rates have to be at zero. It's even if they go to 1%, we can't afford it. So rates are locked at a rock bottom level. What we really need to do is allow interest rates to rise, and they're going to rise substantially. And when that happens, the debt would be defaulted on. And we can't move forward dragging all this debt. So the debt has to be defaulted. And that's how we get out from under the problem. Is, you know, it's just like a jubilee, a debt, you know, the debt goes away. But that's not, you know, a panacea, because for every debtor, there's a creditor. So when the debtors, you know, default and, you know, just, you know, get rid of their debt so that they can move forward, somebody loses, right? There are a lot of people who are on the other end of that. They're owed the money. And it's going to be a startling, you know, wake up when they realize they're not going to get paid. Because a lot of people are counting on that money for their retirement or to fund all, you know, insurance or all sorts of things. And we just don't have the money. But what I ultimately think is going to happen politically, because we don't have the guts to actually do that, is we're just going to keep printing money and printing money. And eventually the bottom's going to drop out of the dollar. The world's going to abandon it as the reserve currency. And it's just going to go into free fall. And debt's going to be wiped out through inflation. So the debt's going to get wiped out one way or another, either because it's defaulted because rates go up, or it's inflated away because rates never go up. But the result is the same for the creditors, the lenders. They get wiped out. Yes, they get their money back, but they can't buy anything with it or very little with it. So they get wiped out through inflation as opposed to default. The irony is, by choosing inflation, they'll actually end up suffering more. I think the real losses due to inflation will actually exceed what the losses might have been due to default, because, you know, it wouldn't have been 100% default. It's not like the creditors would lose everything. Not everybody would be able to default, and some people would still have to pay something. So I think in real terms, a restructuring of the debt due to allowing interest rates to rise is actually better for the lenders than hyperinflation that wipes them out completely.
Yeah, so Jerome Powell gave his speech yesterday. And
I can't hear you.
Oh, hold on. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me?
Now I can, yeah.
Okay, good. So Jerome Powell gave his speech yesterday at the Jackson Hole Symposium, and it was supposed to be about a supposed taper that we were going to have. But he said that the interest rates are going to remain at zero for the foreseeable future. And he didn't really make any indication that they're going to actually tackle inflation or, you know, try to tighten anything. So how much longer do you think that people are going to buy this and they're not going to see that the emperor has no clothes? Because we're actually finally starting to see, inflation affect everyday prices on things, and people are starting to realize it's happening. So how much longer do you think they can get by with this, with just bullshitting the American people?
Yeah, you know, I addressed the speech yesterday in great detail on my podcast last night. So yep. Anybody can watch it at my YouTube channel or listen on Schiff Radio. But this speech, this Jackson Hole speech, was highly anticipated. I mean, they've been talking about this thing for months because this was the time that Powell was going to finally unveil the taper. I mean, actually, you know, say when it's going to start and describe how it's going to work, you know, the process, how long it's going to take, how quickly, you know, we're going to end QE and what the, you know, the increments will be for the taper. And in fact, the dollar had been rallying, gold stocks had been getting crushed because of, you know, all this taper talk, because this was supposedly this tightening cycle. And I've been pointing out that tapering isn't even tightening. You know, they're still doing QE. It's still easy money. They're just slightly, you know, letting up on the accelerator. They're not stepping on the brake. So, you know, it's more inflation being added into the mix. But when Powell actually delivered his speech, he didn't even use the word taper. He didn't even mention it. He only talked about the asset purchases in one sentence of the entire speech. And all he said was that it could be appropriate to reduce the size of the asset purchase program this year. That's it. Could be appropriate. That doesn't mean that they're going to do it. I mean, first of all, if it could be appropriate, it might not be appropriate. So if it's not appropriate, they're not going to do it. And even if they decide it's appropriate, that doesn't mean they're going to do it. They can say, you know, it's appropriate, but we're going to wait. I mean, saying it could be appropriate means absolutely nothing. So this entire speech was this gigantic nothing burger. It didn't deliver on any of the hype. And, you know, gold did rally on it, about $25. Gold stocks were up. The dollar was down, but not nearly as much as it should, because these moves didn't come close to unwinding the moves that were made on anticipation of the type of hawkish speech that he failed to deliver. He couldn't have been more dovish. And yes, the rate hikes are never going to come, because the Fed is going out of its way. Everybody on the Fed is going out of its way to say, hey, just because we're tapering, don't worry, we're not going to hike rates. They're totally different. And in fact, we're not even going to think about hiking rates until we finish tapering down to zero, which they're never going to do. Even if they start the taper process before they complete it, there's going to be another problem. The economy is going to go down. The markets are going to go down. Something bad is going to happen, which is going to cause the Fed to go back to an even bigger QE program than the one they tapered.
Yeah. You've always said that you envision it being an inflationary crisis at the end. And I agree with you, because every time they do anything, it seems like they're moving in that direction. Is there any chance that at the last minute they decide to try to save the dollar and they actually hike interest rates through the roof? Do you think there's any chance they do that? Or is it just pretty much no way? They're just going to keep going this way?
No. There is a chance they will do it. I mean, they're going to wait until it's a real crisis. So they're going to have to make that decision when, you know, everything is collapsing. You know, they're not going to do anything to avert a crisis. Right. All they care about is delaying the crisis. So they won't try to do anything preemptively. But at the point where everything is collapsing, where the dollar is in free fall and prices are skyrocketing, and you really start to see the public, you know, protesting inflation, and that is the main thing that they're concerned about, then they may do something. But, you know, it may be too little too late at that point, because they've waited so long. But to the extent that they can save the dollar, it will come with a heavy cost to the economy, because they're going to have to raise interest rates substantially and let the chips fall where they may. So, you know, they went up to 20% when Paul Volcker was a Fed chair. And the U.S. had a lot less debt in 1980 than it does today. It had a far sounder economy. We had trade surpluses, not trade deficits. We were still a creditor nation, not a debtor nation. So you would think that rates might end up going much higher to save the dollar this time. So maybe 30 or 40%. I don't know where they're going to go. And of course, I think the inflation rate is going to be much higher. So remember, when rates got to 20%, you know, we had inflation at like 13 or 14%. So, you know, the real rates were 7. But this time around, we could have inflation of 20, 30%. And so, you know, nominal rates have to get way ahead of inflation in order to bend that curve. And, you know, Americans are so levered up, everybody is so levered up, that the U.S. government would actually have to default. And this is the real, you know, disaster that's coming, is that the U.S. government has no choice but to default on the national debt. That means people that own U.S. treasuries aren't going to get their money. And there, you know, because hyperinflation will effectively be default, because you'll get money that has no value. But the only way to avoid hyperinflation would be for the Fed to let interest rates go way up, and then the U.S. government can't afford to service the debt, let alone repay it if our lenders want their money back, which they're entitled to. Once a treasury bond matures, you get your money back. Now, what we do now is we give somebody their money back by selling another bond to somebody else. But if nobody wants to buy the bonds at an interest rate that we can afford to pay, well, then that's it. You know, it's like Bernie Madoff, we're done. The Ponzi scheme is over. So in order for the Fed to save the dollar, a lot of people that think they're going to get dollars aren't going to get them, because the government is going to default on its obligations. And it's not just going to be obligations to pay bondholders. They're going to have to default on Social Security, on government pensions, on Medicare. So everybody who's expected to get dollars from the government is going to be told that they're not going to get them. Now, the way to avoid that, of course, is the Fed doesn't do that. The Fed lets the dollar collapse. It doesn't try to save it. And then everybody gets their Social Security benefits. Everybody gets their Medicare benefits, except they don't have any value when you get them. So you get a Social Security check, but you can't buy anything with the money. And so that's the same thing as not getting a check at all.
Yeah, so the dollar has more than its actual value because it's the world reserve currency, but we're kind of playing we're playing the line with how much the world will tolerate. I was wondering how much perceived value do you think we will lose if the dollar is no longer the world reserve currency?
Well, I mean, we lose a lot, because we're totally dependent on that now. I mean, how do you think we're able to sustain these massive trade deficits? It's $1 trillion a year, basically, now, of trade deficits. I mean, Donald Trump, when he ran for office in 2016, he was going to turn that situation around. He said America was losing on trade. Well, when he left office, the trade deficits were bigger than when he took office, and they're getting bigger still. So this is all being financed by the dollar's reserve status. Look, I mean, oil is still priced in dollars. Major OPEC nations are accepting U.S. currency for their oil. So people around the world that want to buy that oil need U.S. dollars. I mean, so that helps, you know, America, because we're basically printing oil. But all this is going to change. And then we can't live beyond our means anymore. If we want to consume, we have to produce. If we want to borrow, we have to save. So we're going to have much higher consumer prices. We're going to have much higher interest rates. But the whole economy is built on the foundation of artificially low consumer prices and artificially low interest rates that are a byproduct of the U.S. dollar's status. And our whole service sector economy, right? Everybody talks about how, you know, we have a service sector economy. Well, what makes that possible? The dollar's reserve status. Because even though we're a service sector economy, we buy a lot of products that are produced. Well, how do we get to do that if we don't produce them? Well, we export the dollars we print and import the stuff everybody else makes. But how can we do that? It's because they want those dollars because of their status. But if the dollar was just another currency, the only reason anybody would need dollars would be to buy American products. But we're not making that many products. We have a huge deficit. So the dollar would collapse, and the trade deficit would eventually go away, because we would no longer be able to afford to import all that stuff. But that would completely change the landscape in America, because all these shopping centers and malls that are full of stuff, the shelves would be empty. You know, to the extent there was anything there, it would be too expensive for most Americans to afford. So we'd have to start bulldozing those strip malls and building factories. You know, we'd have to start training our workers. You know, a lot of guys who have wasted a lot of time getting liberal arts degrees that are worthless, they're going to have to learn how to work on a production line and actually make stuff. because we're going to have to do that. But it's not easy to replace that and build up the supply chains again and the industrial base, especially with the high level of taxes and regulations we have now. I mean, when we built up our industrial economy in the first place, we didn't have all that. We had very small government, and so we were able to create all these industries. But in today's environment, with big government, lots of regulation, lots of taxes, it's going to be hard, to repeat that process.
Yeah. So China is poised to overtake our GDP by 2028. I'm wondering, do you think that China is going to have the next world reserve currency, and do you think it'll just be pegged to gold, or do you think the world reserve currency is actually going to be gold?
Yeah, well, I think that once the dollar loses that status, I don't think the world is going to simply anoint a fiat replacement. The only reason that the dollar achieved this unique status in the first place, and this happened as a result of Bretton Woods, was that the dollar was basically gold. It was as good as gold. That's what they said. Because the dollar was backed by gold, and even though American citizens after 1933 couldn't exchange their Federal Reserve notes for gold, foreign central banks could. And so it was these foreign central banks that, in theory, were keeping the U.S. government honest, because they could take every 35 Federal Reserve notes and get an ounce of gold. That was the commitment we made. And that was the deal, and that's how the dollar became the reserve currency. So before the dollar was the reserve, gold was the reserve. Gold backed up all these currencies, which was what gave them value and made them legitimate. But foreign central banks replaced their physical gold with U.S. government IOUs for gold. And the reason they did that is because they could take those IOUs and buy U.S. treasuries and earn interest. And they were earning no interest on their gold. So we made them a deal. Hey, we'll hold your gold here in Fort Knox. Take this piece of paper. We'll pay you 5% interest. And we'll store your gold for free. And it seemed like a good deal, right? Everybody trusted us. You know, if you, I don't know if you remember the Animal House movie. You know, you effed up. You trusted us. But that's basically what the world did. And, you know, we screwed them in 1971. So I think that when the dollar does really collapse and the world is going to move past the dollar, I don't think they're going to say, okay, let's just go with the euro as the reserve, or let's just go with the yen or the Chinese RMB. I just don't see that happening. Once you've lost so much money on the dollar, you know, just substituting it with another piece of paper, that it potentially it's going to be the same thing. So I think the world is going to return to the gold standard that it was on prior to the dollar standard. Now, that may happen through another sovereign currency that is tied to gold, right? Especially maybe using, you know, blockchain or something like that. A country like China can issue a currency backed by gold. It has a lot of gold, and it can have a gold-backed yuan. And it can make a deal that, you know, you can turn in your digital yuan at a fixed rate and they will ship you your gold, right? They'd have to make it convertible. And to the extent that people trusted the Chinese government, you wouldn't actually have to convert your digital gold to actual gold, because it's far easier to engage in commerce with the digital version than having the metal shipped to, you know, to use, so you can have it in your possession. So that can happen, you know. And to the extent that governments allow it, you could have all sorts of private issuers of gold-backed digital currencies that could circulate, and that could be used as a medium of exchange or as a store of value. But I think all of these foreign central banks ultimately are going to back up their currency with their gold reserves, you know, because that's going to be the only thing that could potentially give these currencies value and instill confidence in the citizens who are holding those currencies, saving and transacting those currencies. If the dollar reserves don't have value, well, what does? What backs it up? You can't have nothing backing it up. So I think it'll be gold.
So how can people prepare for this? How I know you've always said you'll be wrong until you're right, but right now, how far out do you foresee this crisis with the dollar actually happening? I know it's already happening, but when do you see the deadline for when it might not be the world reserve currency anymore? And what should people do to prepare themselves for that moment?
Well, I think between now and that time, and I don't know if it's going to be like, okay, it's like one day. It's just right. gradually phased out, right, over time. And you can already see that process has already begun, right? The share of total reserves that the dollar is has been going down. And you can see more and more countries trying to move away from the dollar and setting up exchanges, trading commodities and other currencies. You see things like China and Russia, you know, having bilateral deals where they're using the yuan or the ruble and they're not using the dollar. So, you know, this is already happening kind of in slower motion. I just think the process is going to speed up based on, you know, how rapidly we are debasing the dollar, you know, with by printing so much money to fund all this spending. But obviously between now and that time, the dollar is going to lose a lot of value before it crashes. So I don't think the dollar is going to crash from where it is now. I think it's going to crash from a much lower level, and it's going to get to that level, you know, more slowly, and then it's going to become, you know, a disorderly implosion. And while the dollar is slowly going down, nobody's going to care, right? The government's not going to worry about it. They're not going to do anything about it. And so what you do to prepare for it is you get out of U.S. dollars and you get out of U.S. dollar-denominated assets, like bonds in particular, but also U.S. stocks. And you do what I've done. You invest abroad. So you invest in foreign stocks. And, you know, the U.S. market has been the best performing market the past decade. But the decade before that, it was one of the worst. It was the emerging markets and foreign markets that did really well. And I think this decade is going to look like the first decade of this century, not the second, especially if you look at the relative valuations. You get much more bang for your buck or, you know, your euro or your Swiss franc in buying foreign stocks. The PEs are lower, the dividend yields are higher, and the economies that I'm focusing on are in much better shape. And many of the countries that we're investing in through the emerging markets stand to gain when the dollar loses reserve currency status, because America loses, so somebody gains. You know, that's currencies, it's all about relative value. So if the dollar goes down, that means other currencies have gone up in relation to the dollar. That means other people are getting richer as Americans are getting poorer. And so as Americans consume less, other people consume more. Because the production of goods and services, that's not going to stop, right? All the factories all around the world, they're going to keep on producing stuff. The difference is who enjoys it, who buys it. Fewer Americans are going to be buying it, and other people are going to be doing it instead. So there's a lot of investing opportunity. So you want to own these foreign stocks, you want to get dividends in foreign currencies, and you want to invest in gold now before it gets remonetized and repriced. And I think the best way to profit from a repricing of gold higher is with these gold mining stocks, because as far as I'm concerned, they're literally giving these stocks away. That's how cheap they are, because they reflect everybody's expectations. People assume that there's no inflation, that it's transitory, that the Fed's going to normalize rates. They assume all this is going to be bad for gold, and they're pricing this into U.S. stocks. They're wrong. They're completely wrong now, just like they were wrong about, you know, mortgages back, you know, before the financial crisis, and they're mispriced. And so I recommend that people load up on these stocks. I mean, it's obviously risky. So, you know, don't put money into gold mining stocks that you can't afford to lose, or at least lose a good chunk of it. But I think if you're willing to accept the risk, I think the upside is enormous and way disproportionate to that risk. Meaning, you know, somebody, you know, puts 50 grand in gold stocks. I mean, worst case scenario, I mean, I guess if all the stocks go bankrupt, they could lose the 50 grand. I think that's very unlikely. But I mean, let's say that's the worst case scenario. But how much could it turn into? Could turn into 500,000, a million, 5 million. So, I mean, it's very skewed in, you know, in looking at the upside. And I think, you know, the upside is far more likely. It's not impossible that, you know, these stocks crash, but I think it's far more likely that they go way up and you get paid much more. So you're making a bet where the odds are in your favor, yet you have this huge payoff if, you know, if the favorite turns out to win. you only, you know, I think it's a long shot that that gold collapses or these gold stocks go down. So, you know, people can do it themselves. But if you're going to get into a lot of the junior miners, which is, I think, where the biggest upside is going to be, I recommend the fund, you know, especially my fund, the Europe Pacific Gold Fund. Adrian Day manages it. And you really got to know this sector, and he knows it better than anybody. He's been doing it for 30 years. There's not that many people who have survived the bear market and done so well in the bear market as Adrian. So he's a great stock picker in this sector, you know, knows all the projects, the management teams. And so he's the guy that you want to have running that portfolio. So he manages for us the Europe Pacific Gold Fund. We also have separately managed accounts in mining stocks, and he runs those as well. From your Pacific Asset Management. And we have more conservative strategies for people that don't want to be in the higher risk of gold mining stocks. We buy a lot of quality, lower risk, dividend paying stocks outside the United States so you can secure your retirement, secure your purchasing power. Because, you know, a lot of people are planning to retire, or maybe they've already retired. You know, they're going to have to, you know, come out of retirement pretty soon or rethink those plans, because their retirement savings are going to retire in many cases before they do, or soon after they do. So if you want to stay retired, you need to have a source of income that will keep pace with the rising cost of living. You're not going to do that with a portfolio in dollars. If you've got a pension in dollars, you're getting Social Security in dollars, you got an annuity in dollars, it's not going to work, because prices are going to go up so much that it's going to render those assets practically worthless in terms of purchasing power, which means that if you are relying on those assets to fund a retirement, well, you have no more retirement. You got to go back to work so you can earn the money that you need to buy those things. Well, if you can get out of dollars now and get out of U.S. stocks and get some income streams that will rise along with the U.S. cost of living, and you do that by investing internationally and getting income in foreign currencies and income tied to commodities or things like gold or other commodities, copper, nickel, oil, agriculture. And you also own businesses that have a lot of pricing power, because as there's more inflation and their costs go up, they can raise their prices without a significant reduction in their sales, because they're selling the stuff that people have to buy, not the stuff that people want to buy. So you have to have the right portfolio to prepare for an inflationary environment. But if you do that now, I think that you can, you know, preserve that wealth and you know, enjoy a retirement. I think if you fail to do that, there is no retirement. You're just working every day until you eventually drop dead.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me this Saturday morning. I'd like to have you back again sometime. But everyone who's watching, you need to listen to this man. I have his YouTube channel linked in the description, along with links to Euro Pacific Capital, Shift Gold, and his Twitter page. Please go follow him there. Listen to him. He's got a lot of valuable stuff to say. Is there any final thing you want to add, Peter? Anything you want to plug?
No, that's good. But thanks, Reed, for having me on. And good luck with your podcast and your channel here. You've had some good guests on. And hopefully you make a difference and more people tune in, and you just get bigger and bigger.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Peter.
Okay.